Welcome to the 2014 CA Area Convention of QAnon Family Groups in Scottsdale, Arizona. My name is Jessica, and I will be your chairperson. Would you please help me open this meeting with a moment of silence, followed by the Serenity Prayer? Thank you, God. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. QAnon Family Group is primarily for you who know or have known the feeling of desperation when there is a problem of addiction to cocaine or other mind-altering substances in someone very near to you. We have traveled the unhappy road too. We found the answer in serenity and peace of mind whether the addict is still using or not. Are there any newcomers to the QAnon Family Groups? If so, we ask this not to embarrass you, but so we may welcome you and get to know you. We welcome you. It doesn't even say that. Okay, so when you come into QAnon Family Groups, you are no longer alone, but among true friends who understand your problems as few others can. We will respect your confidence and anonymity as we know you will respect ours. We hope to give you the assurance that no situation is too difficult to be lessened and no unhappiness is too great to overcome. Our program, which is not a religious one, but a spiritual way of life, is based on the 12 steps and 12 traditions adapted from Cocaine Anonymous. We have found that practice of these steps will bring you a solution to practically any problem. We urge you to take this program and its 12 steps seriously. It has been as helpful to us as the Cocaine Anonymous program has been to the cocaine addict. We only ask for the wisdom and courage to see ourselves as we really are, to do something about ourselves with the help of a higher power as we understand this, and for the grace to release our addicts with love and stop trying to change them. With the understanding that cocaine addiction is a disease and the realization that we are powerless over it, we are ready to do something useful and constructive with our own lives. In QAnon, we share our experience, strength, and hope because it helps us to focus on ourselves and our own recovery. Then, and only then, may we be of any help to others. I've asked a friend to read the 12 steps.
Hi, I'm Kelly. These steps are used by members of Cocaine Anonymous to achieve sobriety and spiritual growth. They were adopted by the QAnon Family Groups for the enlightenment and the guidance of its members. One, we admit we are powerless over cocaine and all other mind-altering substances, and our lives have become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Ten, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
I've asked another friend to read the 12 traditions.
Hi, I'm Melissa. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal progress for the greatest number depends on unity. Two, our group purpose is there is one, but one ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for membership is that there is a problem with cocaine or other mind-altering substances in a family member or friend. The families and friends, when gathered together for mutual help, may call themselves a Kohanon family group, provided that, as a group, they have no other affiliation. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting another group, Kohanon family groups, or cocaine anonymous as a whole. 5, each Kohanon family group has but one purpose, to help the family of addicts. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of Cocaine Anonymous ourselves, by understanding addiction, and by carrying the message of hope and personal recovery to the family and friends of someone addicted to cocaine or other mind-altering substances. 6, a Kohanon family group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the name to any outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Although a separate entity, we should always cooperate with Cocaine Anonymous. 7, every group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Kohanon family groups' 12th step work should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, Kohanon family groups, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Kohanon family groups have no opinion on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. We need to guard with special care the anonymity of all Cocaine Anonymous members. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you. I've asked another friend to read Statement of Purpose.
Hi, I'm Kelly Jean. Purpose Statement. Southwest Regional Convention. The purpose of the 2014 CA Area Convention is to promote unity and enthusiasm throughout the fellowship of Kohanon family groups. Through this effort, it allows Kohanon family groups to financially support the World Services effort to reach out and carry the message to friends and family of cocaine addicts.
And I've asked a friend to read A Relationship of Kohanon and Cocaine Anonymous.
Hi, I'm Terry. The relationship between Kohanon family groups, which includes Coateen for its younger members, and Cocaine Anonymous have a unique and special relationship. Although separate entities, they're all closely allied in their origins. They are mutually and naturally drawn together. Kohanon family groups desires to maintain cooperation with Cocaine Anonymous in thought, action, and spirit. As guided by our sixth tradition, however, cooperation does not in any way result in affiliation, outright or implied.
I've asked a friend to read the anonymity statement.
Jeez. My name is Amanda. Anonymity is one of the most important issues in the structure of Kohanon family groups. Therefore, in observance of the 11th tradition of Kohanon family groups, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, television, and films. We earnestly request that those gathered here honor this condition of anonymity. We request that no record be made of this convention, either by photography, moving or still, or by videotape. If you should happen to recognize someone here who identifies themselves as a member of Kohanon family group, please keep that knowledge strictly to yourself.
All right. So tonight I have the opportunity to introduce our speaker. Her name is Jan B. from Phoenix, Arizona. I've had the amazing gift to know this spiritual teacher for me anyways for the past 15 years and some change. And I just know I definitely would not be the person that I am today She's given me the ability to communicate to humans through God. God has worked right through her, and she truly, truly is one of my earth angels. So I'll give you Jan.
Hi, I'm Jan, and I asked Jessica when she called to ask me to speak. I said, I don't do Kohanon, except this is the second time I've spoken. And I said, that's okay if I introduce myself as a member of Al-Anon. She said, absolutely. So I am a very grateful member of Al-Anon. I certainly couldn't say that when I came in 1982. But I can certainly say it today. And it was funny, we were laughing before the meeting because the topic is trust and intimacy. So I thought I knew what intimacy meant. So I go to the dictionary and I look it up, and one of the definitions is not a healthy sexual relationship between two people, but an illicit sexual relationship between two people. And I'm like, wow, I bet that wasn't what Jessica had in mind when she asked me to share. But not that I didn't have a lot of that on my journey to recovery, but, you know, I always found alcoholics very fascinating people. So a little bit about my history. I don't like to spend the majority of a talk on my history, but I think it's important to establish how it was and what happened to get me here and what it's like since I've been here. And I was born into a multi-generational alcoholic family. On my daddy's side of the family, we're Scots, and we go clear back to Scotland. Lots of alcoholics, multi-generational. And my dad's dad was an alcoholic, and my dad was an alcoholic. And but there was no alcohol in our home, but a lot of insanity, and both of my parents were perfectionists. So I grew up in this perfectionistic home. And because I grew up in a perfectionistic home, there was no room for mistakes. And so I learned to lie. I was an extremely good liar when I got to Al-Anon. And actually, for a few years after I got to Al-Anon, I still lied. I would lie about anything. It didn't matter. I'd lied so much. It was such a habit. It was a way of life for me. And one time I brought home a B on my otherwise straight A report card. And Daddy said, I know you'll do better next time. So that's what it was like. He was the perfectionist for life outside the home. And my mother was the perfectionist inside the home. She actually had a white glove that she put on and went around the baseboards when my brother and I cleaned house. We started doing that when I was 6 and he was 4. And so there wasn't much room for mistakes. Had to be very good all the time. And so I was constantly looking for ways to get out of. I didn't know who I was. I never felt like I belonged in the world because I was always the tallest thing in school until I think maybe I was a senior in high school. There were a couple of football players taller than me. But they went with friggin' cheerleaders who were 5 foot nothing, you know. But I was always different, and I always felt apart from. And so I became a model when I was in high school because you're never yourself when you're modeling, never. If you're on a runway, you're, you know, Miss Extravaganza. And if you're doing photography or whatever the photographer wants you to be. So, and then I became a drama major in college, which was perfect for me. I mean, it's, you're never who you are. You're always something else. And I didn't know who I was. I was constantly playing a part somehow, some way in my world. And I met my first alcoholic husband, and I knew he was an alcoholic. I used to joke about it. But after we got married, I had dropped out of college, and we were going to go back to college. And I did that thing that we all do. Oh, well, he'll quit drinking when we start school. I really thought that. And that didn't happen. And a few years into that marriage, he became violent, and I became what I call a Wonder Woman wimp. I was, by that time, I'd gotten my graduate degree. I had a profession. I was one kind of person outside the home. And in the home, I was this wimpy little whatever I needed to be, I thought, to keep the peace so he wouldn't be nasty and rage. And I was in fear of my life. He threatened to kill me many, many times. And he became a white-collar crime investigator for the Maricopa County Attorney's Office after we moved back here. And when I finally had had enough and was filing for divorce, he used to call me in the middle of the night and tell me that he was put out a contract on me, and one day, years from now, I was going to go out and start my car and blow up, and nobody would ever connect it to him because, after all, he was a cop. So life was very, very scary with him, and there was lots of drama. And toward the end of that marriage, I read a book on alcoholism, and it was the first thing I even knew about alcoholism. And the book talked about alcoholism as a disease, and that was a whole new concept for me. However, it didn't mention Al-Anon. I still knew nothing about Al-Anon. So I got out of that relationship, and I spent a year or two on my own reading every self-help book I could get my hands on, because the next one I read was going to have the answer, you know, the answer. And so out of doing all that, what I came to was, you know, my husband had needed me. I needed to be needed. And so I went out and found somebody to need me, and that person was a paranoid schizophrenic, ex-outlaw biker pot addict. And that person really needed me. And we dated, I don't know, 3 or 4, maybe 5 months, and then we just knew we were made for each other and moved in together, and were together for 2 years, and in that 2 years, he physically moved out 16 times. Moved back 15. And when I finally knew I had had enough, I asked him to leave for the 16th time. And he never came back. Until just after I hit my Al-Anon bottom. And I spent about a year after that, I became a workaholic. I was working about 80 hours a week. If you went home at 5 o'clock or had a weekend, there was something wrong with you. And I was constantly in resentment toward you. And I filled my world with work. It's all there was. I worked 7 days a week. I worked about 12 to 14 hours a day. I was an absolute mess. And so on March the 17th, 1982, my mother was in town visiting, and my brother at that time worked at the Registry Resort. And so he took us all to dinner. And I was very, very tired. I was tired all the time. You know how we get. We're tired. There's just so much to do all the time. We're so tired. And I was so tired. And people at work all day had been asking me, "Are you okay?" "I'm just fine. I'm just tired." And so we go to dinner at a 5-star restaurant, lovely restaurant, and I couldn't eat. I weighed probably at that time, I don't know, 105 pounds or something. I was a stick. And I couldn't eat. I was exhausted. And I got up to go to the restroom, and I had grown up with low blood pressure, and I fainted my whole growing up life. And so when I said to my family, I'm going to faint, they like hopped too. And I said to my brother, I'm going to faint. And he said, not in here. And he gets up and he rushes me out across, was going to take me to the women's restroom, and I collapsed. And I came to 45 minutes later. I was having heart problems. I actually almost died. There was a paramedic, a couple of paramedics there. And they took me to the hospital. And it was a weeknight, and I had to be at work the next day, don't you know? And I said, well, they said, we're taking you to the ER. And I said, oh, do we have to do that? And they said, you have very irregular EKG. We're taking you to the ER. So they took me to the ER, and I left the ER AMA. And because my mother was in town, she insisted I go to my doctor the next day, so I did. And he said, how long are you going to do this? How long are you going to burn the candle at both ends? I've been talking to you for years, and you continue to do this. How long are you going to do this? And I said, well, I need to go to work. And he said, you're not going to work. He said, I've already called your boss. He said, you're off work for a month. And I said, you can't do that. He said, it's already done. And I didn't know what to do. I mean, there I was at home. What do you do? And the ex-outlaw, oh, my doorbell rang. And I always looked through my peephole because I hadn't been with the ex-outlaw biker now in, I don't know, over a year, maybe two. And but he was paranoid schizophrenic, and he hadn't had any meds in over a year. I knew that because I knew other people who knew him. And he was crazy as three bedbugs. And I always looked through my peephole when my doorbell rang. Well, I didn't this time. I opened the door, and there he was, crazy as three bedbugs. And he came in my house, and he upended a bunch of furniture looking for pot. I said, there's no pot here. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and for the second time in my life, I looked death in the face. My first husband trapped me in a closet with a loaded .38, and pointing it at me, saying, I'm going to kill you. And I said, go ahead. And I know today that God must have put those words there, because he started shaking and put the gun down. And I was never, ever, ever around him after that. So for the second time, I'm looking at the paranoid schizophrenic ex-outlaw biker pot addict. And he is going to kill me. And I looked at him, and I opened my mouth, and I said, you know, I think you better go. And he goes, good idea. And he left. And I went and locked the door. And my brother and dad got together and decided I'd go spend the rest of my month with my dad, and which I did. In that period of time, I realized there was something horribly wrong in the way I was living my life. And my brother called me up and he said, honey, I think I am an alcoholic. And I'm going to go to an AA meeting tonight for the first time. And I called, and there's an Al-Anon meeting next door. Would you please go with me? And I said, sure. I would do anything for my brother. I mean, I'm not going for me, you understand. So I went, and it was still to this day the sickest Al-Anon meeting I've ever attended in my life. And it was an hour and a half long, and it was in Scottsdale, and I lived in Central Phoenix, and I drove all the way out there. God forbid I run into anybody I know. And it was a third step meeting, and I'm an atheist, and I had been an atheist by that time for, gosh, 12 years maybe. And so they started this speaker. All she did was talk for 45 minutes about her alcoholic husband and what a creep he was and how horrid he was and how he was this and how he was that. And I'm thinking, and I want this. Why would I want this? You know? And then they have a little intermission, and then they go out in the courtyard in little groups, and they talk about the third step, making a decision to turn our will and lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. And I'm like, let me out of here. So I make a promise to myself. I will never go to another Al-Anon meeting. Except when I was leaving, somebody said, keep coming back. Now, I didn't know you said that to everybody. And nobody liked me. Nobody wanted to be around me. I was not a nice person. And so I thought, wow, they want me back. So I found other meetings. I never went back to that meeting. But I found other Al-Anon meetings. And then I found out it was okay if I was an atheist. Nobody cared. And it was funny. I missed a lot in my first couple of years because you guys would say God or higher power or something, and I would start counting. So I counted ceiling tiles, how many blondes, how many brunettes. There was no sense in counting men and women back in those days. There was one man in the entire valley in Al-Anon, and he was a double winner. And he was at all the meetings, and we all loved him. But, yeah, there was no sense counting men and women. But I would count tennis shoes, high heels. I would just count anything to keep from having to hear you talk about God or higher power. Ugh, it was just gross. So I got a sponsor after a couple of years. Somebody said, you know, Jan, you really do need a sponsor. So I got this Nazi for a sponsor. And she was a Nazi, boy. She is just not your typical idea of a loving, gentle Al-Anon sponsor. And she was exactly what I needed at that time because I thought I knew it all. And she says to me, well, I'm going to take you through the steps. And I go, really? And she goes, yeah, you need to go buy a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because everybody used that book back then. That's what we used in Al-Anon to work the steps. We didn't have an Al-Anon big book till 1995. They didn't want to rush, you know. They didn't want to rush. We finished with the first step. She asked me how I felt. I said, crappy. She said, well, you know, okay, I want you to read chapter 4, We Agnostics, for next time. And I went, no, I'm not going to read that chapter. And she goes, excuse me? And I go, oh, no, We Agnostics? No, no. See, I'm an atheist. I don't want to catch agnosticism. No, no, I'm not. And she says, well, I tell you what, Jan, you are going to read that chapter if I'm going to sponsor you. Otherwise, I don't care. Get another sponsor. I went, all right. Because by that time, I had met my soon-to-be second husband who was in recovery. And so I thought, well, I better just do it. So I did it. So we're in the second step. And she says to me, you know, do you have any kind of higher power? No. Why would I want that? She said, well, because one of these days you're going to need that. And I said, well, all right. She said, well, get something. And I said, all right. She said, what will you get? I said, well, I was out hiking the other day in a riverbed, and I got this really pretty rock. And she said, a rock. And I go, yeah. And she says, all right. So I call her with a problem. And she goes, have you talked to your rock yet? And I go, why would I do that? Because your rock's your higher power. So talk to your rock and then call me. Click. She would do that all the time, hang up on me like that. And so I talked to the rock. Well, nothing happened. You know, I want you to fix this. Nothing happened. So eventually she says, you're going to have to get something other than that rock. That rock doesn't seem to be working, does it? And I go, no. And she goes, well, get something. Well, I loved Jonathan Livingston Seagull. It was one of my favorite books. I loved Jonathan. You know, Jonathan didn't think he could soar, and he soared. His belief changed. He had trusted that he couldn't soar. And then he tried it, and he did it. And then he could trust that he could soar. So I got Jonathan because he was a bird. He could see more than me. He seemed friendly, you know. So I got Jonathan, and Jonathan was my higher power till 1987. He was really terrific, actually. I learned to talk to a higher power all the time. And so my second husband and I married, and a couple of years after we married, he relapsed. And he went to treatment, and he gets out of treatment, and he relapses again. And we had separated because I didn't want to live with the disease anymore. I had made some progress. And so 2 years later, after he relapsed, 1988, he found cocaine. And then he found crack. And life totally changed for me. I just thought I knew how to work an Al-Anon program. And we lived apart, and 1990, his dad died, and he had no money, and he was doing motel time in jail. And he said, could I come home? And I said, well, you can sleep on the sofa. So he came home, slept on the sofa, and I start working a very hard Al-Anon program. Because he would not come home all night, and then he would come in, and he would have blood all over him. His clothes, he was an impeccable dresser. His clothes would be torn, and there wasn't a mark on him. He would go to low-life bars and pick fights and go to the crack house and beat somebody up outside the crack house, and life was just getting completely and utterly insane. I mean, insane. And so I had a different Al-Anon sponsor by then, and I kept calling her up saying, you know, I have got to get a divorce. And she said, well, do you have perfect peace around that? Well, you know I don't have perfect peace around that. He's driving me nuts. She said, well, when you have perfect peace, my understanding is that's when our higher power is saying it's okay to do something. We have perfect peace. Great. So life goes on like that. And one day, I had a business appointment at 8:30. He walks in at 8 o'clock. He's bloody and torn. And I took one look at him, and I had perfect peace. I wasn't angry. I didn't wish him any ill will. I had perfect peace. And so after my business appointment, I said, you know, I need to talk with you. And he came out and I said, you know, we're done. I said, I don't know where you're going to sleep tonight. It's not here. You need to pack a bag. You can come back this weekend and pick up all the rest of your stuff. And he left. And I spent another couple of years I did a lot of inventory. I did a lot of step work. I found out what my part was with all of that. And I made up my amends cards, and I put them in my purse. Because, of course, he's out there. And I meet Paul, and we eventually moved in together, and life was wonderful. I was with somebody who was absolutely sober, worked a very, very good program, had a sponsor, talked to a sponsor, worked the steps, actually made amends to me when he needed to. A wonderful, it wasn't without problems, but it was a healthy relationship, and we had true intimacy in that relationship. We could share our deepest feelings with each other, and it was safe to do that. We made amends to each other. We could share deep, deep, dark feelings. It was really, really great. And we had some major challenges. His oldest son became a meth addict, and so I learned to work my program around an adolescent who was addicted to meth. Well, there's something else different and new. I had never done that, and that was an incredible challenge. And but made it through that. And life was really going well. 1999, Paul had gone to the Saturday morning AA meeting at Crossroads East, and my Al-Anon home group is Wake Up with Al-Anon, Saturday mornings at 8:30 at Crossroads East. If y'all ever want to come, it's a great meeting. And he comes home from that meeting, and he says, guess who I saw at the Crossroads, and he was sitting with the residents. And I go, who? And he goes, Bill. And I go, Bill who? And he goes, Bill, your former husband, Bill? And I said, what? Mind you, I have amends cards in my purse. He said, you know you're going to see him. And I go, yep. And he goes, and what are you going to do when you see him? I said, I'm going to walk right up to that effing son of a bitch and tell him I want my money he owes me. And he said, what? You have carried amends cards in your purse for years. By then it was, I believe, 7 years. And I said, yeah. And he says, and you're going to do that? I said, you are so right. So the next day, we went to Diet Coke, Sunday nights at Crossroads East. And we come out, and I'm talking to a sponsee out in the courtyard who had been on vacation. And then we leave, and we're driving away, and Paul says, you saw him, right? And I go, who? He goes, Bill. I go, he was there? He wasn't in that meeting. He said, no, he was in the courtyard 5 feet from you the whole time you were talking to your sponsee, Alan. I could have asked that son of a bitch for my money. And he goes, honey. And I go, don't honey me. So now it's the roundup. The AA roundup was at Mountain Shadows, and we go to the Saturday night speaker meeting, and we're walking back to the truck, and it's this like single file narrow little sidewalk, you know, and I'm following Paul, and I'm behind him, he's behind somebody. He turns around and he says, you saw him, right? Who? Bill. I go, where? Was he in that meeting? He said, well, I'm sure he was, but he just walked right by you. And I went, what? And I turn around and look, he is running down the breezeway. Get away from me. Running. So next Sunday, last Saturday in August. So I'm in my small group at Saturday morning, and I go, if that son of a bitch is out, I'm telling them. And they're all sitting there, because this does not sound like me. If that son of a bitch is out there on that patio, I'm going out there, I'm giving him a piece of mine, I'm going to tell him he, blah, blah. And they're all just sitting there. Now, I've been going to that meeting since the early 80s, and Bill knows I go to that meeting. It's been my home group forever. So there's a window in the back door leading onto the patio. So when the meeting's over, I'm thinking, I'm going to look out this window and I'm going to see where he is. And I look out the window and he is running across the courtyard. Because he knows it's time. And he's running, I'm sure, to get away from me. Well, see, what happened was I saw him, finally. I saw his face. I saw the ravages of crack cocaine. I mean, when I asked for the divorce, I would have thought he was going to die in a year. And here it is, all these years later, and there is that face with all the ravages of the disease on it. And I just, like, every ounce of anger and resentment that I had just went poof. It just left. And by the time I got out there, of course, he was gone. Well, the next Saturday was the first Saturday in September, and we have a step meeting corresponding with the month. It was the ninth step meeting. So in my little group, I'm kind of with some of the same people, and I said, if he's out on that patio today, I'm going to go tell him that I owe him amends. Would he be open to that? And because I have learned to trust the process of the steps over time. You can't work them as many times as I have and not learn to trust that, you know, a higher power is definitely at work. And so I go out, and he is sitting in a chair directly across from me. And I start walking toward him, and he starts leaning back in that chair. And he's leaning back so far in that chair, it's tilted so far back, I'm thinking, oh my God, he's going to fall on his head. But he didn't, and I went up, and I said, hi, and he said, hi, and I said, how are you? And he said, I'm better. And I said, well, I'm happy to hear that. And I said, I've got some of your stuff in storage. He said, well, I'm planning on being here a year. I said, okay. And he said, and I said, Bill, I said, I owe you amends. And I said, when you're ready to hear him, I would be oh so happy to make my amends to you. And he goes, you owe me amends? He was incredulous. I said, oh, yeah, some pretty big ones. And he says, well, I'm doing my steps. I'll be there in about 2 weeks. I said, okay. So in 2 weeks, after the Saturday morning meeting, I took him over to the park, and we sat on a table, and we made amends to each other. And what that taught me was, if I do the steps and I am sincere about it, and I did not realize until Paul told me he had seen him that I was not ready. You know, the eighth step says made a list and became willing to make amends. I was not willing. I wasn't ready. I didn't know that until Paul told me he had seen him. That's really the most major experience I've ever had of thinking I was ready to make an amends and found out I wasn't. And I learned that experience was so powerful for me because what it taught me was I absolutely have to be ready to make an amends. I can't make them before it's time. I just can't. They won't be sincere, and I'm not going to get free. And so I have learned intimacy. I want to talk about that. How much time do I have left? A couple of minutes. I want to talk about my relationship with my higher power. It's the most intimate relationship I have today. In 1987, I was having a very, very horrible time. It was February of 87, and my life was just a mess. And Bill had relapsed. I was terrified of financial insecurity. I had Jonathan. I was just a mess. And I had been out one night with a friend of mine, and I came home, And every time I talk to Jonathan, I always use Jonathan's name. Hey, Jonathan, or Jonathan, I've got a problem, or I need your help, Jonathan. I always use Jonathan's name. And I crawled into bed that night, and I pulled the covers over my head, and I curled up in a fetal position, and I said, help. And for the first time since Jonathan had been my higher power, I didn't say, help, Jonathan. I just said, help. And the entire space under those covers lit up with this just incredible kind of a blue-white, ethereal light, and I fell asleep. And I woke up the next morning without fear for the first time since I was 3.5 years old. My granddaddy died when I was 3.5, and after he died, I was just fearful every minute of every day. And I woke up without fear, and my higher power ceased being Jonathan in that moment. And I learned over time, Paul's had a couple of dry drunks in our relationship. I've had tons of problems. January 1st, he had a massive heart attack and was in the hospital for 35 days. He had a quadruple bypass, a pacemaker, a defibrillator. And the 18th day he was in the hospital, I'll never forget this. In the room, they had brought his dinner and he wasn't eating, and everybody was trying to get him to eat. And so there were two of his sponsees, two of mine, and in the room with us. And my phone rang, and my brother had been suddenly very sick. And the phone rang, and I had this god-awful feeling, and I took it, and it was my sister telling me that he had died. My younger brother. And I couldn't tell Paul, because Paul loved my brother, and they were close. And here's what my relationship with my higher power is so intimate today. I was sitting out in the waiting room on the CVICU unit, and I knew I had to go back in that room. And I said, God, you're going to have to get me back in that room. I cannot do this by myself. You're going to have to do it for me. And I was walking down the hall, and one of his sponsees saw me and came out and said, did he die? Because they all knew. And I said, yeah. And he hugged me, and the others came out one at a time and hugged me. And then I could go in, and I could be there for Paul. And I could be, I was funny, I was cajoling because he wasn't eating. And we all got him to finish dinner. He actually ate dinner that night. And if it weren't for the relationship that I have with my higher power, I don't know where I would have been, not just this year, but all the time I've been in Al-Anon. My relationship with my higher power is the most intimate thing in my world. And then there's Paul. He's the second. Incredible. I have learned to trust, even when I don't believe it right now. I have learned to trust because of my experience over the years that my higher power is always going to come through for me in my highest and best good. It may not be what I think is my highest and best good, but it is always my highest and best good. And my daddy died April 11th. My brother died January 18th. My daddy died April 11th. And I was talking to my sponsor the other day, and I said, she says to me, have you even stopped to think about what your life has been since January 1st? Because she said, honestly, I don't know how you're even doing life. And she said, you're not even just doing life, you're having fun. Most of the time, some days I'm not, but most of the time I can get up, I can do my world, I can go to work, I can work with my sponsees, thank God for my sponsees. I have an amazing lineage. I have the honor every year. If y'all have never been, it's really fun. Jessica is my chairperson of everything at my Al-Anon Steps Workshop Retreat every year in at Little America in Flagstaff. This year, it's going to be the second weekend, next year, the second weekend in April. So put it in your books. I'll make sure y'all get flyers. But the thing about trust and intimacy is I learned as a kid I could trust. I lived in an unsafe home. I had a lot of trust around that because that was the action. Bad action happened over and over and over, and I learned to trust this is not safe in this house. In recovery, I have learned to trust that if I get up and I do the deal and I talk to my higher power in the morning first thing and I end with a talk with my higher power at night, if I look at my part, if I get pissed off at whatever, the four words I say to myself all the time are, what is my part? You know, those four words have led me to my part and seeing where I owe amends, and I can trust the process. The step process works. The lineage process works. I've had the same Al-Anon sponsor for a gazillion years now. I adore her. She knows everything in my life. I have not one secret from her, not one. She knows everything there is to know about me. I can trust she is always going to be there for me. And she is never going to give me advice or tell me what to do. What a gift is that. So I don't know if I hit too much on that topic, trust and intimacy, but I know that they are a hallmark of not only recovery, but life before recovery. Before we get here, we trust that life is not a safe place. The world isn't safe. We're not going to be safe in it. And we have to fix everything. You know, we got to make it okay. And after we get here, we learn to trust little by little by little that we have a power greater than ourselves who's taking care of us. And we don't have to be in charge as much as we want to be. We don't have to be. And we can let go and let God and live a life. I live a life today truly beyond my wildest imagining. Could never have imagined the life I have today. I would not give up the life I have today for anything. It is an amazing life. And thank you all so much. I pass.